Welcome to Bible class, those of you here and those online. So we've got Russell's third session on 101 Bible skills. So Russell's asked that we read section from Psalm 119 again. And we're going to read from verse 97 through to verse 112. Thanks, Russell.
Oh, good evening, everyone. Grand. Third session. Has anyone counted up how many Bible skills we've mentioned so far? I feel terrible. I feel a little bit like if you've read the book of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. When they're in the chocolate factory, Willy Wonka's running them from room to room to room. And to try and condense down what it is that is possible in terms of biblical interest is a fearsome task of culling and choosing, and I will make some mistakes. There will be some areas where you'll think that something should have been said and it wasn't, and that's true. We're still dealing with the same thing. This is the third time through, but we're just taking a different emphasis each time. So trying to get the cogs turning, because all the different aspects of biblical skills tie together. They feed back on each other, and often if you strike a barrier one place or another, then you can get it going again by getting another part working. If you struggle to read and get information, you may choose to collect for a while and listen to other people's ideas for a bit until you're re-inspired to hit the text yourself. If you've done a lot of reading, then maybe it's actually time for meditation, or maybe what's holding things up is that you haven't found a way to do what you've learnt. And so it's all feeling a bit academic because you haven't made the connection through to action. So three general things. Hopefully we can, through what we've been saying, let you come to feel that a biblically inspired life is a creative process. It's not a boring process. It's not a something sort of musty and on the shelf. Because even though the biblical text isn't changing, our lives are. And there's always new things that we need to try and relate if we're going to live a biblically inspired life. Just think of the way that lockdown last year made us rethink what ecclesial life is and what fellowship is. And we suddenly read the same texts, but we've now got a different approach. And we have to think, well, how do we do this now that we can't? The Jews have been good at this through history, haven't they? Because there's a law and it's got sacrifices and temple, and then they've got no sacrifices and no temple. And yet somehow Judaism has continued on, and they are often quite creative in their solutions. And that's why I don't shy back from having bright colours that look like paint splotches for the logo, because it would be much better if we can see the challenge of living a biblically inspired life as something which is not just black and white. The second thing I hope has been coming through is there's actually a huge range of different skills, and realizing that nobody has all of them. We're going to see some of these tonight. The question is, what do you do when you recognize you haven't got it? So use what you know, develop what you don't, and by any means possible, find workarounds to avoid stalling. If you find something you can't do, instead of letting it stop the process, find a way around. Ask someone. Find a solution. And so they realize that Bible skills are something which grow. Make use of the community that you have. Now, I would have liked to have been able to say that biblical stuff is all really simple. The trouble is, it's not. You can't make it more simple than what it is. You can't to oversimplify is perhaps not the goal. But I do want to say at the outset tonight, not everything has to be complex. So if you're looking at through this and thinking, oh, there's too much of a process to get from A to B, not everything has to be complex. And I'd like to just take a really simple example right at the start so that if the rest blurs out, then at least there's something. So I hear some of you have been reading from the letter to James. I'd just like to quickly take you through a process. So, Hebrews, James, and James chapter 1. Verse 19 says, "Know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God." The words there aren't difficult. The message there is straightforward. It doesn't particularly matter what the underlying original language says in these places. It's readable in English straight away. So we have a chance to meditate and we think, well, how can I be quick to hear and slow to speak? How can I make that work better for me? We come up with an idea, and here's one. Every time we have a chance to usher forth our opinion, we instead first ask one more clarifying question from the other person. Before we launch off into our own opinion, we take the chance to listen to what the person's saying and ask one more question to try and understand where they're coming from or to broaden our perspective of their problem. This will force us to hear a bit more. And it will slow us to speak a bit more. So there we are. We decided that our action will be a habit, a simple habit. Whenever there's a chance to go forth with our own mind, I ask one more question of the other person first to understand a bit more their perspective. And how can I share it? Well, when someone in the first week or two says, "How come you're listening to me now?" You can say, "Well, I read this book, this verse in the book of James that said this, and I thought this about it, and it's quite a simple rule." Maybe we can see how catchy it becomes. So living biblically does not have to be complex. And I hope you'll remember that as we hit some complexity. The trickiest bit with biblical skills is getting started. Because everything fits together, everything interconnects. Just on the bottom corner there, the best way to pick up new skills is to learn techniques from people you admire. This is a little bit like make use of community. If you're not sure how something's done, ask someone else who you know does it to give you their best tips. That will be quicker than hitting a great big textbook with all the details. I wish we'd spend a bit more time on first steps because I think it's really useful. The main thing for us here tonight really is if anyone's starting out in Bible study and any of those 10 are things that you think I really don't have a grasp on, then that's a good early project to start on. If you haven't got a sense of the storyline or the types of books or a sense of inspiration, then work on those things first through there. The case studies we didn't spend as much time on as we ought to have as well. But there is an ongoing use for those. Does anyone still have their little pieces of paper? Is it gone? Good. But there's a real value in keeping those potential case studies in mind. So what did we have? And I'll modify number C. We had someone who doesn't know anything about scripture, number A. B was someone who struggles with reading and with literacy. C, going to modify it a bit, is someone who doesn't have our local language, English, as their first language. D was someone who's really trying to re-explore their foundations. And E was someone who's losing motivation and is in danger of being lost entirely. Why is it worthwhile to remember these? Well, next time you're working on an ecclesial plan, think how well it works for A, B, C, D, and E. Next time you're writing a talk, think about it, how it would be heard if A, B, C, D, or E were in the audience. Because while our average audience is not made up of these first five letters, if any of these first five letters are in the audience, they're the ones that are most going to benefit from whatever we say. Most of us are pretty immune to new ideas. We've been hearing them for a long time. But A, B, C, D, or E are the ones where the ideas that you present might actually really make an influence and an impact in their life. So they're useful just to keep in mind. Okay, so we want to spend tonight on reading skills. Good Bible study is all about good Bible reading. And probably the biggest point is that second one. Read aloud. Don't have to read out really loudly, especially if there's other people just down the corridor or that sort of thing. But in terms of reading, when you read aloud, you naturally find points of emphasis. When you read a passage out aloud, as long as you will know whether you have got the point of the passage by whether you can read it well. If you've emphasized the wrong word, it's going to sound really clunky. Some of the most inspirational studies you can hear are hearing the Bible read really well. It almost needs no interpretation. David Suchet, who plays Hercule Poirot, has put out an NIV reading of Scripture, which is, as everything else is, available online. Just pick a psalm or a small letter and see how much difference it makes just to hear the Bible being read really well. The other thing reading aloud can help do is help us avoid really bad errors. Sometimes, if you listen carefully to a talk and you pick up all of the words that are being emphasized by the speaker, and you think, if all of those words are emphasized and I tried to read the verse that way, I would know I've got it wrong. You can't read a passage of text and emphasize every word. It's just not natural to do that. And so reading aloud can help correct errors of bad emphasis. The second thing, we'll look at it more soon, is about the size of chunk that you work with when you're trying to read scripture. We can end up focused too close to the text and looking at word by word by word when sometimes the picture is in the paragraph or the sentence or a larger chunk. Second to last comment there, most parts of the Bible were intended to make perfect sense to the people who first heard them. Now, they may be difficult for us to understand, but they weren't trying to be difficult for the most part. Now, we know the parts that are trying to be difficult, the great big symbolic prophecies and things like that. They're meant to be cryptic. But when we're reading an epistle from Paul, he's trying to be obvious. He's trying to put himself forward in a clear sort of way. And so, at last, we get to the point where we get to read the text for ourselves. What are we going to try and get from it? What's going to head from our reading into our knowledge base? And I suggest we've got four things from any bit of text. So the first one is observations. These are the facts. These are the bits of information that we find to be useful from a text. What it's about. The second one is principles. What is the underlying point being said? What is the message? What is the purpose behind? So look for facts. Look for principles. Third, look for exhortations. What is it asking me what to do or how to do it? And fourthly, look for questions that will take you to the next place. Where next? What if? What's not said in this verse? So we'll come back at the end if you haven't got those down. But even if you just... every time you're in a piece of biblical text, and you could split your page up into four sections. And as Jeff was talking last week, different people will find it easier to fill the different. Some people are much more attuned to the facts, others to the questions that arise, and so on. And this is where working with each other is helpful. Now, so we're at the point where we really just want to get into the text. We've talked a lot about scripture and around the subject. And we're really pleased to be able to now finally get ourselves back in and really get into the Bible for ourselves. You can spot it from... Okay, so we're gazing back. You want to get to the original text. Here we go. Right? I want to read the Bible for myself. Well, here is as close as we have to the Bible, this piece of, it'll be animal hide. Exceptionally good ink for 2,200 years old. This is older than Christ. And here is the text that we're asking ourselves to engage in. Do you spot any difficulties? I think the handwriting is incredibly good. I would have written so many more crossouts.
It's running the wrong way.
Yeah. You say, well, okay, so that's Old Testament, but what if we go to the original Greek? Is that easier for us? Well, the lines are nice and straight, and maybe they go the right way this time.
Looks like a barcode.
Yeah. QR code you can do on it. This is one of the earliest Greek manuscripts. Did you see that they even economized on spaces and punctuation? Now, so here's the text that we're saying we want to engage with, and we need to recognize that there is a gap, isn't there, between the text itself and our understanding of the message in the text. So, as I said, we don't have all the skills. How many of us here are fluent in Greek and Hebrew? So we have to use a workaround. Now, this is no different to other skills that we might think come easy to us. So we have to make use of translations and translation notes. Those words in the Greek and the Hebrew, what do they mean? Those words, where else do they come in the document? Not the English words, but the Greek or the Hebrew. Sorry. Yeah. Is it okay to use a workaround? Well, we have to, because we don't know the language. But we just have to realize whenever we use a workaround, we need to be humble enough to recognize that that puts a limitation on how dogmatic we can be about what the text is saying. And given the fact that we don't all speak Greek and Hebrew, let's almost picture ourselves when we're dealing with the text as like when you're having a conversation with someone with whom English is not their first language. Right? You can get the message across, but you know sometimes how strained or how difficult that can be. And that's us trying to work with the Greek and the Hebrew. It's not just Greek and Hebrew as foreign languages, it's also from thousands of years ago. The Bible's set a long time ago. The best way to understand the text would be if you're someone from the original audience. Then you would understand the turns of phrase, you would understand exactly what's being talked about, you would get the humour that is there in some of the biblical texts. And so again, we have to use workarounds, find out about the time and the place. Try to get into the language of the Bible, even if it's not quite the way we would say things. One area where I think you could all help each other quite a lot, there you go, is there's quite a change in the way that we use biblical reference works. Some of us are still fully paper. Some of us have gone completely digital. We should talk to each other about what apps we use and what resources we have, because there's some really good things around. But if we don't talk about it, then one person discovers it and nobody else realises that, oh, that could be easy. So there. We'll come back to that one. Okay. 3 minutes and then I'll be getting you to do an activity because it's a little warm in here. And it is 8 o'clock at night. So, 4 things that we're going to ask about any text. We're going to wonder about its context. Where does it come from? I'm going to try and comprehend it. What's it trying to say? We're thinking about its companions. What other places will help me understand this text? And then we have a checklist of things that we often do with texts. But let's think about context very quickly. Every bit of the Bible and different bits of the Bible at different times, different places, they all come from a context. A writer writes to an audience. Sometimes the time of writing is the same as the time being written about, but sometimes it's not. And you'll know that when you say, read through, somewhere in Genesis and it says, now this place used to be called that, or they used to call seers prophets or prophets seers. So somebody's writing about a time that is even for them historic. So sometimes the time of writing is not the same as the time being written about. And it's set in a place, in a time, in a society that is different to ours. And that's why we wait for the bridegroom to come rather than waiting for the bride. Because it's not our place, it's not our time. That's why military power is described by number of horses, because it's not our time. And somehow we want to try and bridge that gap. Some books of the Bible, we really don't know who wrote it, and we really don't know who the audience is, and we've just got to make a good guess. Any text also has a literary context. What sort of writing is it? What sorts of writing are in the scriptures? There's poetry, there's prose, there's stories, there's law, there's genealogies. These are all different sorts of writing, and we need to read them with that in mind. Also, who's speaking in the text? Is it a standoffish narrator, or is it a person speaking directly? What's the voice we hear as we read the text? And the section of text's place in Scripture. Where is it within the Bible? Within a book, what section is it in? This is important because reading, getting your chunk size right, I haven't got the right term here for this one, but it's as good as I could get. Understanding the units that we should be reading with, I think, is quite helpful. We all know, I'm sure, that chapters and verses are relatively new creations. 1100s for chapters, 1500s for verses. They're good to help you refer to the text, but they're not always the best for splitting up the text into sections. So when you read, don't worry too much if you're crossing over chapter breaks or verse breaks. So what sort of chunks are books composed of? So the Gospels, like Luke, is 24 chapters, but really it's about 100 little stories, and each chapter has two or three, four episodes in a chapter. When you write a letter, you're writing a letter as a whole. It seems strange at times to stop reading partway through a short letter. So look at the letter as a whole, but then you'll split it up into paragraphs on topics. I'll skip a few because you can read as fast as I can. Proverbs. Often they're one-off. Just a single proverb at a time bears no particular relationship to the one before it or the one after. Sometimes it's in small groups. At the end of Proverbs 31, the virtuous woman is an A to Z. It's meant to be seen as that whole. So you wouldn't try and find a meaning in one verse that undoes the picture of the whole. And so think about it when you're reading as to what the real chunks are, what are the sections in the text. Yep, it's time to take an activity break. So here you go. We've got 5 minutes. Are we allowed to turn our chairs around? Oh, good. The freedoms we have these days. Grab one or two other people with you. Take a random section from one of these passages. Perhaps even choose it now before I tell you what you're going to do with it. Have a think. What sort of genre is it? Who is the writer of this passage? Who is the audience of this passage? When was it? And what's the voice of the writer? Is it a narrator or is it someone more actively involved? And then, here we go, and this is where those who have more recently been to high school will outshine those who haven't. What figurative language can you find within your chosen passage? So see if you can find a simile, a metaphor, an idiom, a hyperbole or a hyperbolic statement. Can you detect some irony or some sarcasm or a type? So here you go. We're just going to do probably 7 or 8 minutes, so to 15:15. Try and mix a little bit. If you're looking at these things about figurative language and you don't get any of these words, then maybe share your time with somebody who might. And of course, if not, we can always Google it. If you're drying up in terms of the figurative language in your passage, then feel free to put an example of any of those from anywhere else in the Bible. Yeah. Bonus points for sarcasm. Oh, that's. Oh yeah. So what sort of figure of speech is that? The act, considering. Good. Okay, let's regather. And that's good. Did anyone struggle with genre, or was that pretty easy? Yeah. Cool. What about, did anyone struggle in their passage to find who the writer was?
Hebrews.
Hebrews, yes. Still some debate on that one. What about audience?
Yeah, Adam and John.
John, yeah. Who is John writing to? We don't know. Yep, good. Yours?
Sheep.
Oh, no.
So we need Psalm 23. So the Lord is my shepherd.
Yes, I am a sheep. I am a sheep. Yeah, it's still singular, isn't it? I am a sheep. Yeah. Good. Does anyone want to share a particularly good bit of figurative language that they found in their passage? Yes. Good. Some of them are more tricky than others. I would suggest that actually when you... figurative language, in some senses, figurative language is unnecessary. There would always be a much more literal way of describing things. And yet the Bible is full choosing to go the figurative way. And so many things, and it trips us up so much in terms of our understanding of Scripture. The four most controversial words in the Bible are not hard to understand on the face of it. This is in the greater Christian context. This is my body. Right? Now, to the Catholics, that means a miracle takes place, which requires a priest to officiate, because actually this is the body. Or is it a metaphor? So we might look at something like figurative language and think, oh, it's an extra. But actually, when you look at most of our unique doctrinal positions, it's us trying to figure out, is this a literal or is this a personification? Is this a figure of speech or is it actual? When they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years, is that an actual time frame or is that a symbolic time frame? We'll be talking about the kingdom of heaven. Does that mean we're in heaven or not in heaven? So getting the figurative language right is a major part of the comprehension. Not taking things literally when they ought not. Not over-symbolizing where we shouldn't. Companions. The Bible is a very interrelated book. So always look up the parallels. There are the same or similar incidents all over the place. There are two sets of histories of Israel. There are four Gospels. But not just the parallels. It's also the book of Acts and the epistles of Paul interweave with each other, often describing similar events. The prophets of the Old Testament interweave with the history. The Psalms, likewise, interweave with the stories of David and Israel's history. So not just the passage, but where are the other places that talk about similar things? Look for companion verses in terms of same idea or themes. Look for companion verses where they share the same word or the same phrase. Now, phrase searching was always very difficult to do until the digital age. Word searching was something we got very good at doing because we had a tool that did it, which was our concordance. So look at companions. Oops. And then for any text that we look at, here are some of the the other things that we often do. Why is it, do you think, as Christadelphians, we like doing the first two? If it's in the Old Testament, is there a type of Christ? If it's in the New Testament, is there an Old Testament root or echo being told? Why is that us?
Well, we believe that the concept of Christ was there from the very beginning.
Yes.
So the beginning is Genesis and it's Old Testament, and we're looking for shadows or pictures of that.
Good. Yeah.
We believe all the Bible is
fine. Yes, we've got a very integrated sense. You have to understand the old to understand the new. And so we like the links between the two, and we believe that it's all of one from the inspiration point of view, so that you can look in other places and still find the same hand at work. So, good. But in terms of the checklist, like some people like doing various different things and they look for it everywhere. But put on the checklist your topics of interest. So when you've decided, I want to think about what does the Bible say on this or that, well, keep it in the back of your mind for 6 months. And as you work your way through through various different chapters of the Bible, you might find that topic being talked about in surprising places. So keeping your own little checklist of things to be looking for is well worthwhile. Coming up with a doctrinal conclusion is one of the hardest tasks to the Bible reader, because a doctrine is something that we're so sure of that if we find a verse that goes the opposite way, we then have to explain it away. But to be so sure of it, we have to have thought about almost every place where it impinges on that subject. So while we talk about them as first principles, as the basics, actually in terms of deriving the first principles, if all you had was the text of Scripture, is a much bigger task. Just before we move on, how do we choose a translation? Because we're all just English speakers, our primary way of being able to get to grips with what the text is saying is to choose translations, maybe to choose more than one. Recognize that when you're using a translation, every translation has to make a choice, has to make a number of choices. And translations fit on a spectrum where on the one end there's those that choose to translate word by word, and at the other end those that choose to translate idea for idea. And you'll have in your mind some of the different translations that are like that. When you translate at the word for word end, you end up dragging through into English all sorts of things from the original language. The figures of speech are the figures of speech of that language, not of your own. And so it's sort of harder to work through, at least until you're familiar with it. When you go with a translation that's more idea for idea, they're more inclined to try and translate the figure of speech to something that you can identify with. And so it's worthwhile in our reading of Scripture to use a variety of translations along that whole spectrum. But what would we choose as our main version? I'm calling it our anchor version, the one that we have as a wide margin Bible, if that's what we have. Probably something more towards the word-for-word end. The reason for it is that then words in one place of Scripture will match up with words in other parts of Scripture. So it becomes something where we can compare Scripture with Scripture more easily. Where was it? Sorry. That's all right, I'm going to do it. Um, I still think it's worthwhile having a Bible to call your own. I think many resources have very well gone digital and are actually easier to access often that way. But I still think it's good to have a set of scriptures on paper. The mind is geared towards remembering scenes, and every time we have a page view, we have a scene. And our memory is well suited to remembering pages. What that means then is you want to have a Bible that you use a lot and that you use repeatedly, and so then your mind will become familiar with the scenes of each page. I use a ESV Bible now, but my head is still geared to the King James of my childhood. And so sometimes when I'm thinking about a passage, I'm looking it up in my head in my old Bible and then finding the same spot in the chapter and in the new one. But it's worthwhile thinking carefully about what version you hope to make the one of your memory, because it will be with you for a while, hopefully. So for me at the moment, I mainly use three different translations. The King James is still in my head. The ESV is the one I use for my move around Bible. And I also use the Net Bible as my one. It's, in terms of its text, it's more at the idea for idea end of things, so it reads quite gently. But it's also got notes in behind it where the translators go into how they chose to come up with that phrase to put in their Bible. So you get sort of the best of both worlds in that one. Easy to read, but it's got the backing behind it of what the translator's choices were. But make your own selection, but probably just two or three that so that you can get familiar with them. So there's the text. From any text, we want to get these four things. Make observations, facts, to go into our accumulation of knowledge. Useful facts, of course, not just how many words are in this verse or something like that, but things that you know are going to connect. What principles or ideas are in there? What exhortations or requests for what we should do? And what questions am I left with after I've read this text? To whisk our way through the other sections, let's just see how this all fits together. So these will go into our knowledge base. They get combined with insights that we've learned from others. And hopefully, if we've got things a little bit organized, we can start to merge some of these things together to form a more solid view. This gets combined with our observations from life, the questions that arise, the perspectives we hear from other people, the observations we make. And if we've collected all those things together, then that's what is prep for our meditation cycle. Here's all the material that we've got, the perspectives that we've gained, and now it's time to roll around in our mind the questions or issues that we're interested in. Toss them around in your head. You've done the research, now think about how it all fits together. And as we had from last time, there are other questions that you can use to explore topic in a meditative type way. The Werther test, how long does it take to suck a Werther's original toffee? You can't Google this one.
Seven minutes.
Cool. Something like that. Don't say you've thought about a topic until you could have got a Werther out of the way. All right. So, you know, we often say, "Oh, I've got to think about this." Well, let's put some solidity to what this think about means. Yeah. So as long as it takes to get through a boiled sweet without thinking about anything else, and that's really hard to do, but it's worth a go. So you can use this as a retort to someone. Have you given it the Werther test yet? All right. Do you still think the same after you've thought about it for 7 minutes or 23 minutes, whatever the acidity of your saliva is? By rolling it around in our minds, that gives our background mind chance to notice that this is what we've been thinking about. We can't direct our background mind, we can only feed it, and it works away in the background to make sense of the problems that we've given attention to. It will give us lots of ideas back, some of which are good, some of which are bad, and there's lots of opportunities to feed back around the cycle. Do I need to look up something more information-wise? Is this an area I need to think about more? But what we hope to have come out of our meditation cycle is a settled perspective on a topic. Here's what I think. You know, you hear someone, you know, some people know their mind on a topic as opposed to, oh, yeah, maybe, whatever, right? But what we're trying to get is a settled perspective and something that we can put into action. Action itself is a whole set of skills, which we talked about briefly last time, about sometimes the challenge for us is just trying to get that first step going. I want to finish with this idea with regard to sharing. There are so many ways that we can share what we learn about Scripture with other people through so many different media, that there's no reason why all of us couldn't get busy sharing a bit more. When you share, it's less about telling others what you know, more about helping others to see for themselves what you've seen. And the little diagram up the top there. So say where the smiley face on the bottom, right? There's the star. We've seen the star. We're looking at the star and think, oh, wow, that's a wonderful star. But if we just tell others what we know, and sometimes what we're really asking someone else to do is, this is a star, but you can only see it if you come over to where I am. And from my vantage point, yeah, that's what it is. And I think some of the best of sharing is when you think, hey, but they're looking at it from over there. How can I tell them? How can I show them how they can see the star for themselves? And then people really appreciate what sharing is. This is a work in progress. I hope at some stage to actually have 101, and I will let you know if I get there. One of the best ways to get something started is to make a commitment towards doing it. And putting a topic down as a Bible class is a good way of making sure it happens to some extent. But I do hope that I've given you some things to think about. I do think there's room for talk within the Ecclesia about the new range of Bible study resources and how to make use of them well, because particularly the next generation are not going to have the same sort of bookshelves and libraries that the older ones amongst us have grown up with. Start the wheels turning. Thank you.